Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's recovering from a voice treatment and will be back next week. Quiet has returned to Bangkok following days of violent clashes between anti-government protesters and security forces. Thailand's prime minister says the government has a reconciliation plan to move the nation forward. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton warns North Korea of consequences for sinking a South Korean warship in March. North Korea denies the charge. And Iran allows the mothers of three detained American hikers to visit them in Tehran. Joining me in the studio to discuss the week's top international stories on our Friday News Roundup, Tom Gelton of NPR, Ann Guerin of the Associated Press, and Jonathan Landay of McClatchy Newspapers. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, Susan.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We're going to invite our listeners to join us later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, let's start with talking about the situation with the Korea. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton this morning in Tokyo said that it's important to send a clear message to North Korea after the charges that they were responsible for the sinking of that South Korean ship, saying we cannot let this attack on South Korea go unanswered. Let me be clear, this will not and cannot be business as usual. So, Ann Guerin, what is it that the United States and other countries can do if it's not business as usual?
Well, frankly, not that much. I mean, we do have a security pact with the South, and this was under sort of ordinary circumstances, looks like an act of war. But we are not going to attack North Korea or help the South attack North Korea in the short term. Most likely responses would be something at the United Nations, additional sanctions, some other kind of international security regime that cracks down on North Korea. There are already a number of such regimes in place, which have not stopped the North from doing a number of the things, including apparently amassing missile parts and counterfeiting that has worried the West in the past.
So, Jonathan, why is there a conclusion at this point that the North Koreans were behind the sinking?
Well, it's based on physical evidence that was recovered from the sinking of the Chonan. Beg your pardon, a warship in March to the loss of 46 South Korean lives. Basically, in addition to physical evidence from the remains of the ship itself, which were hauled to the surface, they recovered the propulsion unit or much of the propulsion unit from the torpedo that hit the ship, and the physical evidence showed exact similarities with the blueprints of a North Korean torpedo that the South has, the torpedo that is sold by the North to Iran, markings on the remains of this propulsion unit as well.
And yet North Korea says that they are not responsible, Tom Gelton.
Yeah, of course they say that. You know, the North Koreans are playing this in the manner that they play crises like this, like they have in the past. I mean, they know, as Ann said, they know that the United States and South Korea are not going to go to war. So that gives them a lot of flexibility, gives them a lot of leeway. They can be very provocative. They can threaten all-out war against the South if there's any kind of military move against the North at all. And basically what they can do is extort South Korea and other countries, saying, look how dangerous we are. If you don't deal with us and deal with our needs, this is the kind of damage that we can do. And they know that there are very few options that the West has. I think one argument, and I think it makes sense, is that right now there is a real kind of political crisis in North Korea around the issue of who is going to succeed the current leader, Kim Jong-il. And they may want a period where they sort of retreat from the international scene. So they, you know, even if the outcome of this is further isolation, that may actually fit their political needs right now.
And indeed, what adding to what Tom says, one of the theories out there, because of course no one really knows what the North Koreans are thinking or what may have motivated this attack, is that they want this period in which they can decide the succession to Kim Jong-il, but also perhaps in doing so put off any chance for a resumption of the six-party nuclear talks that the United States, China, other world powers are involved in trying to deal with their nuclear program. There were efforts by China to try and get those talks restarted, and it may well be that the North Koreans don't want to engage in those talks right at the moment, and therefore that may have also been a motivation.
So this sounds so Machiavellian that North Korea would sink a ship in March, and then with a torpedo that's easily identified as theirs, and then when it's discovered, say, no, it's not ours, but it's all part of an actual strategy?
Well, they have a history of doing provocative, warlike things, apparently to get attention. They often come at a time when the world's attention is focused elsewhere. And they shot a missile across the Sea of Japan and completely freaked out the Japanese and the Americans a few years back. They've done a number of these things, which have no, from a Western perspective, no real logical outcome that could be good for them, but they certainly do attract attention.
And of course, South Korea and other countries worry that if you do very much about it, you'll provoke some kind of irrational or dangerous response from North Korea.
Well, you know, Susan, the one significance here is it's probably going to mean an end to the so-called sunshine policy that has been South Korean government policy for a number of years now, which really involved various kinds of engagement with the North in terms of travel and in terms of economic cooperation. The North is really forcing the South Koreans now to sort of turn away from that, and they clearly have their own strategic reasons for doing that.
They could, of course, count on China to ensure that they don't collapse completely, at least economically, because China doesn't want a tumultuous end to the regime where you have millions of North Koreans flooding into northern China. And that may well be what, you know, the North Koreans' calculation here is. As long as China's got our back, or as long as we know that China is going to do what they have to prevent the collapse of North Korea as a state, we can do what we want.
China playing an important role also on the issue of additional sanctions against Iran. Russia and China have signed on to tougher sanctions at the United Nations. After this odd Turkish-Brazilian pact with Iran that was revealed this week, Anne, tell us about that.
Well, it mirrors something that the United States and other big powers actually offered to Iran as a partial way out. More than a year ago. It has the benefit from Iran's perspective of sort of cutting the U.S. out of the deal. It was negotiated on the side with countries that are business partners or friendlier, at least to Iran, than the five major powers that have been, rather the six that have been seeking sanctions.
Well, what this Turkish-Brazilian deal, if it's sort of parallel to a deal that was being worked on before, is it something the United States was interested in accepting? Was it taken seriously, Jonathan?
Well, there was a bunch of major flaws with the deal, but the biggest one being that it would not have required Iran to comply with repeated UN Security Council demands that it suspend its uranium enrichment program. And indeed, Iran announced right the same day that the deal was struck, on Monday, that it would continue to enrich uranium, not just up to the 3.5% that it needs to fuel for nuclear power reactors, but up to 20% for a research reactor in Tehran. And this was a major sticking point among other. There were other holes in it from the U.S. and perspective, but that was a major sticking point.
And the other thing, Susan, is that we're talking about the same figure in both the first attempt and this attempt, which is 1,200 kilograms of low-enriched uranium being turned over. That's about, 2,600 pounds or so. And the problem is that in the meantime, Iran has continued to enrich uranium. So what they would be turning over now is a much lower proportion of what they have than if they had gone through with this in the beginning. And there is a concern that what they've produced in the meantime now would be enough for them to build a nuclear weapon.
And they could unilaterally declare that the deal wasn't being observed properly, and they could unilaterally tell Turkey where this, where their uranium would have been kept. We want our uranium back.
You know, and we had these poignant scenes from Tehran of those three American hikers being allowed to meet with their mothers. Why did the Iranian government allow this to happen?
It's a really curious question. I suspect that they're looking for a better face on what has become, in some respects, a public relations liability for Iran. They've been holding these three Americans since last summer. They're very appealing. It's a very appealing case. Their families have been very vocal, unlike the families less of two other Americans with dual nationality who have also been imprisoned in Iran for varying amounts of time. The Iranians have been probably looking for some way to make bargaining chips of these three. And it seems to me that the expiration date for that has probably come and gone, and the Iranians are trying to figure out what to do next.
Iran managed to use these mothers in order to pursue those very aims of arranging some kind of swap by bringing the mothers there. And, of course, the mothers are very anxious to see their kids. The Iranians arranged for them to meet the mothers of several Iranian diplomats who had been held by U.S. forces in Iraq. So this gives them an opportunity to make a connection here, which really is in their interest.
Tom Gelton, he's a correspondent with NPR and author of Bacardi and the Long Fight for Cuba, the biography of a cause. And we're also joined this hour by Ann Guerin, national security correspondent for the Associated Press, and Jonathan Lande, he's the senior national security and intelligence correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. We're taking a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and take some of your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And for the second hour of our news roundup on Friday, we're joined by Jonathan Lande of McClatchy, Ann Guerin of the AP, Tom Gelton of NPR. Well, Bangkok is calm after months of tensions and protests, a violent peak on Wednesday. How did the government handle these protesters, Jonathan?
Well, this was the culmination of actually 4 years of political turmoil in Thailand. It is not going to be probably not the end of the political crisis in Thailand, but finally the government decided to move using troops, armored personnel carriers, in a very aggressive way, violent way, against the so-called red shirt protesters who had occupied the center downtown Bangkok. At this point, I think the death toll is up to about 77 when I checked this morning. The protest leaders surrendered and called on the protesters, on their followers, to give up. At least some of the protest leaders. There are some that appear to have gone underground. The reaction from their followers was violent. There was something like 36 buildings set afire, including the stock exchange, one of the world's biggest shopping malls. The damage is enormous, and we're going to have to wait to see how the government pursues what it says it's going to do, which is a reconciliation process. Troops are still on the street in Bangkok. But the Prime Minister, Abtisit, says that he is going to try and work this reconciliation process. But there are calls to resist that from some of the opposition and calls for his resignation.
Here we have a question submitted on Facebook from Matthew, who asks, what sparked all this conflict in Thailand? What's the core issue, Tom?
Well, Susan, you know, somebody once said that revolutions rise not out of despair, but out of hope. And that really applies to the situation in Thailand. Thailand has enjoyed a lot of economic growth in recent years, rising prosperity that has improved the lives of everybody. It has improved the lives of a lot of the poor people in the countryside, working classes. However, it's improved the lives of the wealthy even more. And as this wealth comes into the country, this is kind of an aspect of modernization. You get growing resentment that it's not being shared equally. And so even though the lives of many of the poor people in Thailand have really improved in recent years, there's resentment. There's great resentment. It's bringing out latent social tensions, which really hadn't flared before. And it really is a phenomenon of modernization and economic change.
And the man who kind of symbolized this change for, in particular, people in north and northeastern Thailand, where about a third of the population lives, is the former prime minister, Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted in a military coup in 2006, allegedly over corruption and other practices by the military and apparently by a group of elite industrialists and supporters of the monarchy based in Bangkok, and he had, despite all of the alleged corruption, his conviction on corruption, had instituted very popular programs that had a major impact on poverty alleviation in the country.
Here's an email from a listener who asks, what kind of protests may be expected in the northern areas that are predominantly red shirt? What would be their target? Government buildings, university, banks, or foreigners? I have concern for my daughter, her husband, and my young grandchildren who will soon be living and working in Chiang Mai. Not sure I'm saying the name of that town properly, but what might they expect in those northern areas?
We have to wait and see. There was trouble up in the north, particularly in around Chiang Mai, which is the major city in the north, one of the major cities in the north, and it's very hard to say right now. Under an agreement that was reached with, or at least under the reconciliation plan put forward by the Thai Prime Minister, they're supposed to hold parliamentary elections in November. But it now appears doubtful that he's going to hold to that schedule. And it's just and even if he does, it's very doubtful that people in the north who were the core of this movement are going to accept his continued leadership in the government. It's very hard to say what's going to go on now.
You know, we certainly hope that things go okay for this American family that's locating there. And in terms of geopolitics, does this matter to the United States? Is this important to us, how things go in Thailand?
It is. It's been a country with relative stability in an area that is, Tom said, has been undergoing enormous economic and political change. We've got a longstanding military relationship with Thailand. They've been a rock of our Asia-Pacific military policy. And more importantly, it's a country that the United States could do business with and saw as a partner, if sometimes one that some political leaders in the U.S. wanted to hold their nose while dealing doing business with, that held up at its end of the bargain. And our relationships with other major, larger, better-known powers in Asia are all changing. And obviously, Thailand is very much in flux now. It was sort of a safe harbor that's no longer one.
Here's a caller, Robert, calling us from Raleigh, North Carolina, who wants to talk about Thailand. Robert, hi. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for taking my call. My wife and I traveled to Bangkok, Thailand, last summer. We're very fond of the city and very sad to see the unfortunate developments there. But my question is, I've heard allegation that the opposition protesters are actually being funded by the political opposition, and I wondered if there's any truth to that claim.
All right, Robert, thanks for your call.
The former Prime Minister Thaksin has actually been using Twitter express support for what was going on. There are allegations that he's a multi-billionaire telecom mogul. His family has enormous business holdings in Thailand and other parts of Southeast Asia, and there are allegations that he has been a primary source of funding for protests in Bangkok.
Let's take another caller. Scott is calling us from Indianapolis. Scott, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you very much. This could be probably a very naive question and impractical, but it involves the North Koreans, and it strikes me that when one of your the panel there suggested that they do this whenever the attention is away from them, they do a provocative act, but we're very limited in what we can do in response. I mean, 40 people were killed, and yet there's very little we can do because of the threat they pose. And I wondered if there would be anything practical to simply ignoring them as best you could when they do low-grade provocative attacks and either make them accelerate what they're going to try to do, or perhaps maybe they'll think about trying to do something more positive to get attention drawn back to their country. Because it sounds like a lot of it's almost sort of like a game where when they're not a center of attention, they want people to pay attention. And so we do, and nothing changes much.
Scott, thanks for your call. Tom.
Well, I think that's precisely what the United States has tried to do in the past, is ignored it. I mean, the United States has a very high threshold when it comes to North Korean provocations. We ignore the vast majority of them. I mean, if you look at the language that comes out of North Korea, it's just ridiculous. It's so hyperbolic. And whether it was the Bush administration or this administration, there's basically been no effort to counter the kind of accusations and provocations that come out.
Here's an email from Dennis, who's a retired U.S. Army person. He says, I had the dubious pleasure of serving in the closest Army medical unit to the DMZ, spending 13 months there in 1974-1975. When I was there, one medical emergency that was flown in was an Army soldier attacked by a North Korean guard at the border where the guard used an axe. I'm not sure what it's going to take to solve the issues over there. North Korea is one very desperate nation. You know, the fact that we have so many troops at the DMZ in Korea makes it hard for us to completely ignore what's going on there.
It does. I mean, there's this sort of weird time has stopped Cold War aspect to the North-South divide. Donald Rumsfeld used to love to show a satellite photograph of the Korean Peninsula at night, which shows the South as a whole bunch of white dots and the North is utterly black. It is sort of the land that time forgot, and and its interactions with the rest of the world are bizarre and unpredictable. On the question a little bit earlier of whether it's useful to simply ignore them, as Tom said, the United States has tried it with varying results. I mean, George Bush tried to walk away from a very tangled set of incentives and talks with the North fairly early on, and they responded by accelerating their nuclear production and exploding a nuclear device. Some people who blame the Bush administration for walking away from talks that might have prevented that, but they certainly haven't shown, the North haven't shown any inclination to respond to really to either treatment, to engagement or to being ignored.
Tom.
You know, in one point that Dennis mentioned, this South Korean soldier that was attacked by the North, one point that people don't realize is how common these violent incidents are between the North and the South. I mean, this, you know, the sinking of this warship, the Corvette, the Chonan, is probably the greatest one. But, you know, hardly a month goes by where there's not some South Korean killed by some North Korean. It happens all the time. We just don't hear about it.
And indeed, there's a theory out there that what this sinking of the Chonan was all about was a North Korean response to a naval skirmish. It only lasted a couple of minutes, I believe, in November, in which a couple of North Korean boats were very badly damaged. I think one may have even been sunk by the South Korean Navy.
Speaking of places where we have a lot of U.S. soldiers deployed, let's talk about Afghanistan. We had two big attacks by the Taliban in Afghanistan this week. Is there something behind these attacks, one in Kabul, one at the big base Bagram?
Well, Susan, you had a great show on here yesterday about Afghanistan that where this the point was made over and over again, and I think it's the obvious one, that the Taliban, wants to make it clear that in spite of this very notable effort by the Obama administration to surge troops into Afghanistan, to make Afghanistan a top priority, to undertake offensives in Marja and possibly an upcoming one in Kandahar, that in spite of all of that, we're still here. We can still strike when we want, where we want. So it really sends a message.
Is that true? In terms of the threat from the Taliban, is it as serious as it ever was?
Well, indeed, the Taliban about 10 days ago declared the beginning of the summer offensive. There was a American helicopter that took an RPG fire down in the south in Nad Ali, which is right next to Marja. There's an expression the Taliban have, the Americans have the watches, but we have the time. And that's exactly what's going on. The situation in Marja, which was the centerpiece of the beginning of this new strategy, is not very good at the moment. Security has not been fully established. The Taliban still control pockets of Nad Ali and Marja. There are IEDs still being planted. There are people who the local population is not prepared to cooperate with the United States. The people who do have had their heads cut off and their families attacked. So this is the nature of an insurgency.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls. You can reach us on our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. Well, we do have thousands of new U.S. troops heading to the southern city of Kandahar. What's our hope there? What is the strategy? What's our goal with this buildup of troops, Anne?
Well, the administration and the generals in Afghanistan have had a terrible time explaining what Kandahar is. They just keep telling us what it isn't and what it won't be. But the simplest way I could explain it is that Kandahar will be the make-or-break test for the counterinsurgency strategy. It's the birthplace of the Taliban. It's a city where some, but by no means all, of the residents have a strong affiliation or some affiliation with the Taliban, but it isn't owned and operated by the Taliban. So the challenge for the United States and the Afghan forces and NATO forces will be to make Kandahar a place that has better, if not perfect, allegiance to the government in Kabul without causing civilian casualties, without grossly overstaying their welcome, or doing other things that would end up being counterproductive.
That seems like a pretty big task, Tom.
But it's true, as Anne says, that Kandahar is really the nub of this whole conflict, in the sense that ultimately it's not about a military campaign. It's about it's about governance reform. It's about establishing governance capabilities in Afghanistan, and Kandahar is the place where, on the one hand, there is a start. There is a local government there. It's a deeply flawed local government, and so the real challenge in Kandahar is to see whether, at the end of the day, there is going to be a viable and effective government in Afghanistan that has the trust and the respect of the Afghan people.
Challenges also to the national government. Some new allegations this week about President Karzai's half-brother, who's been a figure of some controversy for some time. Jonathan, what's happening?
We're talking about Ahmad Wali Karzai, who is the power in Kandahar and its environs. And indeed, next to the Taliban, may be the single biggest hurdle to the American effort to, as Tom was talking about, engendering good governance. He's a hugely divisive figure down there. He operates via a web of tribal allies and security and so-called security companies, unregistered militias. My colleague, our bureau chief in Kabul, Diane Niesenbaum, interviewed him last week. He claimed that there's no, that the operation there has already succeeded and they're just mopping up. But the fact is that he's a highly polarizing figure. He's deeply unpopular there. And if he and it appears as if the Obama administration, because of its July 2011 deadline, and this deadline is something that's really created a very uncomfortable dynamic there that's hard to deal with on the ground by the troops. that they've decided that he, that working with him is going to be a lot easier than trying to push him out. And that mitigates enormously against their objective of creating good governance in this place.
These accusations now come from the President Karzai's own defense ministry. Is he going to be forced, President Karzai, to do anything about this, Tom?
Well, it seems less likely now than it would have a few months ago, because this administration has to say, you know what Donald Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the army you have, not the army you want. And this administration has apparently decided you go to war with the ally you have, not the ally you want. And having made that decision, it seems like the pressure is off Karzai.
The allegations you're talking about are allegations that have been around for a while. And that is that Ahmad Wali Karzai has allowed, has helped allies of his basically heist government-owned land, indeed land owned by the Ministry of Defense, and it's the Ministry of Defense who are making these allegations against him now.
We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Tom Gelton, Ann Guerin, and Jonathan Landay, and we'll take your calls, 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Tarcher Penguin, with Jeremy Rifkin's new book, The Empathic Civilization, The Race to Global Consciousness in a World in Crisis, in stores and online. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, last week NBC announced it was canceling the original version of Law and Order. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to interviews with some of the series' stars, and creator Dick Wolf tells us about one of the series' most coveted roles.
Everybody wants to be the dead body. It's highly sought after because you can't be cut out. So it's a great gig for extras.
Join us.
We have an email from Eleanor, who's writing us from Cleveland, and she writes, Iran, as a signer of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Agreement, can enrich uranium for peaceful purposes. This looks like another ramp-up by the media, NPR included, to scare the listeners into supporting sanctions against Iran. The sanctions seem designed to soften up the country for regime change. Jonathan, what do you say to Eleanor?
Well, actually, Iran has been found in violation of what's known as its verification and monitoring agreement by the watchdog agency that oversees the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the UN International Atomic Energy Agency, because it violated that agreement by keeping its program secret for 18 years, and it wouldn't have been known if a Iranian opposition group hadn't come out and disclosed it. And it has emerged that it based that program on technology that it was sold by the Pakistani led smuggling ring, the AQ Khan ring, which itself, AQ Khan, began his nuclear career in Pakistan by stealing technology from enrichment technology from Europe. So the fact is that Iran has been found in violation of its obligations under its safeguards agreement, but it has not been told it has to get rid of its enrichment program. And this is a very important point. It is not being ordered to get rid of its enrichment program. What it's being told is that it has to come clean on the history of its program. It has to do other things, fulfill other requirements that it's been set by both the IAEA and the UN Security Council. And if it does, only once it does, it can, in fact, resume enrichment.
Anne?
Iran has done a really remarkable job of making the whole question about what it is actually under investigation for or subject to sanctions for into something that of a national issue of national pride. The very simple explanation, as Jonathan laid it out, is they hid stuff and they've done things that seem to be out of keeping with their stated goal of energy production. But in Iran, it has become an issue of we ought to be able to do the same things that other countries can do, and the United States and other big powers are preventing us from doing it.
Eleanor uses a phrase, the sanctions seem designed to soften up the country for regime change, which, of course, became a famous phrase in advance of the Iraq War, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Do you think there's any possibility, Tom, of more aggressive military action by the United States and its allies against Iran?
The key words that you said there is "and its allies." I don't think that there's much likelihood that the United States will undertake military action anytime soon. But there is, I think it's fair to say, a growing likelihood that Israel will take military action against Iran. And then the question becomes, how does the United States deal with that? Does it sort of stand by and provide overflight rights that Israel would need? Does it immediately come to the assistance of Israel if there's any kind of retaliation? I think that's the far more likely scenario.
And what is it that Israel would do if it chose to take some military action?
Some isolated strikes against nuclear facilities in Iran, the way that it did, has done before, whether it was in Syria or in the case of Iraq. I think that I don't know what the Israeli agenda is, but from what we read, it's not to destroy the program; it's to set it back temporarily.
And there were a lot of questions about Israel's military capabilities, whether it even has the ability to reach Iran. I think about last week, the Israelis held a military exercise in which they claimed they do, in fact, have the ability, the mid-air refueling capability, to send their fighter jets to Iran and back again.
And if that happened, what would the U.S. response likely be?
Well, so far, the U.S. response has been to say, please, please, please don't do it. And they would really be on the spot if Israel went ahead and did it. Essentially on its own. There are a lot of theories that the United States really actually secretly does want Israel to do it, but certainly what they say in public is that it would have so many unintended consequences, including to Israel, that it simply wouldn't be worthwhile. The United States would, it seems certain, come to Israel's defense if it became another war in Lebanon, for example. But it really could have a much more far-reaching effect throughout the Gulf and throughout Arab states that the United States would really have a very difficult time containing, or if it became a matter of having to send troops someplace, coughing up those troops to do it. They're tied up elsewhere.
The United States basically controls the airspace over the Gulf. And any other country transiting that airspace would be seen by the United States. And if it was allowed to happen, it would immediately convey the idea that the United States allowed it to happen.
We have several emailers who ask, why does Iran need enriched uranium for power when the nation has vast oil reserves? What is Iran's response to that point?
It doesn't have the refining capacity. It exports oil to other places, but it doesn't have enough of its own onshore ability to generate power to meet its citizens' needs.
And that's the major point. The other point being that it doesn't have the nuclear power plants it needs this fuel for. They do have a nuclear facility that is about to come online. It's Russian-built, and it is going to take Russian-produced fuel. So that's a major question. Why does Iran need to enrich at all?
All right. Let's go to Joseph. He's calling us from Seattle, Washington. Joseph, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
All right. Thank you. I heard not today's program, but in another day I heard someone referring to Brazil and Turkey as members of the non-aligned nations. And my knowledge about history is the non-aligned nations that were established by, founded by the Big Five, which included NASA, Tito, Nkrumah, Nehru, and Sukarno, in 1961, was not against United States or Soviet Union. It was formed to be a sort of intermediary between the two nations because of the Cold War. And that's what was the purpose. But sometimes some members of our press make reference to non-aligned nations as against the West. It wasn't so. It was later on that countries like Cuba and Argentina and I think SWAPO, South Africa, and Cyprus and Brazil actually joined that movement. So I want to bring this to the attention of the audience.
All right, Joseph, thanks for your call. Now, let me ask you, you seem to have a little bit of an accent. Where are you from?
I was born in the Gold Coast.
Yes, all right. Well, thank you very much for your call. Tom.
I was actually asked at there's the non-aligned movement, capital N, capital A, capital M, and then there's small case non-aligned countries. There is still a non-aligned movement, the one that he's talking about. I was at the last non-aligned summit. It was in Havana in the fall of 2006. Cuba is the current president of the non-aligned movement. He's right. It did begin as sort of an intermediary between the Soviet bloc and the Western bloc, but since the Soviet bloc has disappeared, its only adversary is the Western bloc, and it has actually degenerated, I think it's fair to say, into kind of a knee-jerk anti-American movement. But that is separate from what, you know, for example, the G20. I think the G20 is the new manifestation of non-alignment on the global stage, and that's where Brazil and Turkey are playing major roles. They're basically ignoring the old non-aligned movement that is really a Cold War vestige.
Are Brazil and Turkey unhappy with the fact that the United States and other powers are not taking seriously the deal they have been trying to negotiate with Iran?
Yes, but and the Turks probably particularly. But the larger question will be, well, how, first of all, in the short term, how does the United States play this without ticking off two important countries, one an ally and one a close friend? And secondly, does this actually set back the sanctions question, because Brazil and Turkey would be among those that would have to vote on it?
And does it?
Well, right now, you know, Brazil and Turkey are both members of the UN Security Council at the moment. Brazil, the Brazilian representative, said they're not even going to discuss the draft sanctions resolution that was submitted by the United States on Tuesday to the UN Security Council. I think that Turkey, of course, lives right next door to Iran. So we have to wait and see where that goes. And indeed, maybe that, in fact, could become a new point of negotiation, but I doubt it. I think that sanctions resolution was basically a rebuff to both Brazil, which has had its own problems with the International Atomic Energy Agency, with its nuclear program, and Turkey.
Tom, German lawmakers today approved a rescue package to address this debt crisis in Europe. We've seen some repercussions of that, even in our own economy. Tell us what Germany agreed to do this morning, and is it enough to restore confidence there?
Well, this morning, as you say, it's sort of a ratification of the bailout package that has been negotiated. One of the various bailout packages that have been negotiated to save the eurozone, as it were. And it certainly didn't seem to be enough, because the European stock market continued to decline. It's a much bigger problem than that. There's really two dimensions of this, very quickly. There's the economic dimension, which is, what would the collapse of the euro really mean for the global economy, and for the U.S. economy in particular, that would really sort of it would mean that U.S. exports to Europe would be much more expensive, and that would really affect a lot of U.S. manufacturers, particularly in the tech area. It could also precipitate another round of the banking crisis, with a freeze up in credit that would eventually spread across the Atlantic to the United States as well. But just as important, perhaps even more important, is the political dimension of this. The euro currency has become a symbol of Europe. And if the euro currency now becomes unviable, it really calls into question the much larger process of European integration and the idea of European identity and the idea that Europe can continue to be an effective strategic partner for the United States. So there are geopolitical repercussions to this that go way beyond the financial effects.
All right, let's take another call. We'll go to Tampa, Florida, and talk to Karen. Karen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been listening for a while now, and we've gone from North Korea to Afghanistan, Iran. We've talked about Israel. We're going on and on. Clearly, our discussions on international relations. And I think the face right now of the United States and international relations is clearly our military. And I think we need to really consider what that means. I heard one of your guests today talking about patting ourselves on the back for ignoring North Korea. And I think it's a huge mistake for us to go there. It would sort of be hilarious if it wasn't so pathetic that we think that's a good thing. I really think that we need to recognize that the State Department was pretty much dismantled by the Republicans in the, during the Bush administration. And we need to think about what that means. If we have a toolbox for dealing with international relations right now, about all we've got in that toolbox is a hammer. And Gates has even stated this. I have a real concern that we're having the wrong conversation here today. The conversation we need to be having is the conversation that says, what are we doing to build our capacity for peace building, for engaging with other countries, no matter what the problems or how weird they are? And right now, we're not having that conversation, and that's not being done. We're not building our capacity, and surely we have the resources to do that. But that's the conversation I'd like to be listening to.
All right, Karen, thanks for your call. Tom?
Well, with respect to the specific case that, Karen brought up in North Korea, it's kind of hard to see what that engagement policy would involve. I mean, we've tried food aid, we've tried energy aid, we've tried multi-party negotiations. As I say, we've gone out of our way to not respond to provocative comments. I think that toolkit, you know, is pretty empty right now for dealing with a country like North Korea, which seems to have a stake in attention with the United States rather than reconciliation with the United States.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show.
And Jonathan. Indeed, the administration is, as the caller pointed out, the Secretary of Defense has himself acknowledged that there needs to be a huge boost in resources for the State Department. And in fact, that there is an effort to try and do that with regards to Afghanistan that's going on right now.
You know, we talked earlier in this hour about the use of Twitter in the protest in Thailand. We saw Pakistan take action this week against Facebook and YouTube. What was the issue there?
It was according to Pakistani authorities, objectionable sexual and other racy content on those sites. And Pakistan said it first tried to block links to objectionable content, but eventually was forced to cut off access altogether. This is certainly not the first time that a country has done something like this. China certainly has a recent history of internet crackdowns and blocking certain sites. It is, however, a somewhat more thorny question for the U.S. about what they do about it. Pakistan is a country we are courting. I wouldn't quite call it an ally yet, but it's been a partner. It's one that we give billions in aid to and are trying very hard to establish a meaningful relationship that would allow us to leave Afghanistan.
Well, Jonathan, does it work when they try to say block access to Facebook?
No, at the nub of this is a Facebook page that called on people to draw portraits of the Prophet Muhammad. And Pakistan is a very conservative Islamic country. There was a high court. There was a court decision ordering the government to block the Facebook page. It ended up blocking not just Facebook, but YouTube, Flickr. I believe even BlackBerry got blocked. But friends of mine, I have a friend in Karachi who merely went to a proxy server, and he's been Facebooking all morning. And so, no, it hasn't worked at all.
Now, of course, most Muslims regard depictions of the Prophet, even favorable ones, as blasphemous. So they see this as quite provocative, Tom.
Well, I think that the intent of it is to be provocative. It's precisely because depictions of the Prophet have elicited this reaction in Denmark and in other places that that real adherents of a free press have specifically selected this issue to kind of push the limits.
Tom Gelton with NPR, Ann Guerin with the Associated Press, Jonathan Landay with the McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you all for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.